Well, dear students, we're going to finish our discussion of stocks. It's been a long road, hasn't it? With Chapter 8 and Behavioral Finance and the Psychology of Investing. You know, these are things that will help you a little bit with investing, but they'll also help you a lot with just living, because they are aspects of we humans that we sometimes don't want to think are there. And so it won't help you with individual stock decisions, I believe, such as the materials we've gone over in fundamental analysis, but it will help you think about investing and think about living. And then the authors shoehorned a discussion of technical analysis, silliness, at the end. So that's what we're up against today. Let's get started. Slide number one. The investor's chief problem, and even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. Ain't that the truth? Eventually, you're going to read The Intelligent Investor, dear students. Don't read it as your first book. Read One Up on Wall Street or A Random Walk Down Wall Street as your first book, okay? But then eventually, you're going to read The Intelligent Investor. And Mr. Graham skewers the individual investor, and he also skewers the professionals, too. So this is a quote I believe is apropos to this chapter. Slide number two, investor psychology. Psychology? What? What is psychology anyway? The study of psychos? In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asked, So when is the stock market going to recover? The advisor curtly responded, I am an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist. Slide number three. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investors' psychology. And some of the research is very revealing about who and what we are, not only as investors, but also as a species in general. And there's an old Wall Street saying that there are three factors that influence the market: fear, greed, and greed. Yes, dear student, greed usually wins out in the end, unless the world ends, and then we don't have anything to worry about then, do we? Slide number four. So let's take a look at some common investor weaknesses. Reading too much into the recent past. Remember the saying, beware the permanent trend? Yeah, there ain't no such thing. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon, just as the wagon was about to veer into a ravine, now we call it fear of missing out, we trick ourselves into believing that it's different this time. It's a new era. Does anybody remember eToys, The Globe, and CMGI in 1999? How many of you weren't even born? How about condo conversions in 2006? How'd that work out? Oil in mid-2008 when it was selling for $147 a barrel, and 8 months later it was selling for $39 a barrel. Or gold when it touched 1800 or whatever, 1900, and then slipped back to 1200. Hey, 10 years from now, 5-10 years from now, we'll add cryptocurrencies, special purpose acquisition corporations, SPACs, rhymes with smack, and NFTs to this list. Yes, maybe, I don't know, we'll see. Non-fungible assets, NFAs, do I have that wrong? I thought it was NFTs. Things that aren't worth anything. People are spending hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars for something that's not worth anything. I guess it's worth to them that much, right? In the year 2000, somebody spent $10 million for year2000.com. Uh-huh. You think it's worth $10 million now? So, but this is what happens, folks. We see what happened in the recent past, and we figure it's going to continue in the future. Misperceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, we've shown this to be true. History tells us this. Our brains will trick us into seeing a pattern because we humans are heuristic. We look for patterns, even if we know, if we're told beforehand that there aren't any to be found. Yes, in a series of 1 million random digits, let's just say your job was to look at this series of 1 million random digits. The probability that one of those digits, 0 to 9, would be repeated 13 times in a row is essentially 100%. If it didn't happen, then you can reasonably conclude that this list series of numbers is not random if that didn't happen. Of course, if we saw 13 sevens in a row or 13 twos in a row, we'd say, well, that's not random. Exactly. We're told it's random and we see it and we say, but it doesn't look random to us. We're looking for some kind of pattern. In my humble opinion, technical analysts are guilty of this failing. And we'll discuss technical analysis at the end of this presentation. How about being overconfident? Oh boy, don't we think we're the best whenever we do? If you ask a group of 100 people who are excellent or good drivers, who are average drivers, fair, poor drivers, over 80% will typically say they're either excellent or a good driver. It's called the Lake Wobegon effect, where all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. Wait a minute. How can all the children be above? Well, of course they are, right? You believe you know more than you think you know, or you believe that you are better than most other investors. And the truth is, dear students, especially us little investors, not size, I mean in terms of what we are investing, we only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what's happening within a company, an industry, an economy. That's why mutual fund companies have hundreds of analysts all over the world. And we are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we decide to become traders. So that is one of the things we have done our best to dissuade you from doing, is being overconfident. You have to have humility. In my humble opinion, there's an old saying, if you don't know who you are, the stock market is a very expensive place to find out. Slide number 7. Selling your winners too soon and hanging on to your losers. Loss aversion. This is very true of us humans. We hate to admit we made a mistake. So we stubbornly hold on to the losers, hoping that they will at least get back to where we bought in. Remember our discussion of you bought it at 10, it's now selling for 6 or 4 or 3. If you would not buy it now, right? You bought it at 10, it's now selling for 6. If you wouldn't buy it at $6, it's time to get out and admit you made a mistake. And this is a good thing to do, folks. The reality is that our memories are wired to forget unpleasant experiences. You sell your losers and you will quickly forget about them, right? Our brains say, oh, we don't want to think about that anymore. We hang on to them. And every time we look at our screen or our statement, we'll always be reminded of how stupid we were to buy that stock. So if you would not buy it now at this price, then you sell it. Now, maybe you would buy it maybe it's even a better deal at this price. So, okay, think about that too. But people tend to just hang on to their losers because they don't want to admit they made a mistake. But in contrast, hanging on to your winners is what makes you rich. So do hang on to your winners. Don't be tempted to make a short-term gain just for the sake of saying, "Hey, I made 20%." Well, then the stock is still a pretty good deal. But you're going to keep doing your research and reevaluate your positions regularly. Right. Has the story changed? And Peter Lynch was once asked what his worst investment was, and he said, "Well, you know, when Home Depot came out, I bought it, and I'm." and it doubled in value and I sold. And they said, that's your worst investment decision? He said, yeah, it then went up 20 more times. Right, hang on to those winners. So let us now turn our attention to something we've danced around, we've made mention to it, and we got to do it because it's something you should at least know exists, even though I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. The fundamental analysis, which is what we've been doing in chapter 5 and then 6 and 17. The in-depth study of the financial condition and operating results of a firm. A method of evaluating securities by attempting to measure the intrinsic value of a particular stock. Fundamental analysts study everything from the overall economy and industry conditions to the financial condition and management of companies. And so, as we said before, simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. The models from Chapter 6 that we covered, that's fundamental analysis. The ratio analysis that we did in Chapter 17, where we put all these numbers together into a stew and didn't make any decision based on just one number, but we rounded out our knowledge of the company. And then, of course, we read the stock reports from Valueline and maybe Morningstar, and of course we get the download the annual report from and the financial statements from the company itself. Look at their competitors, their suppliers, their customers. That's fundamental analysis. And if you to review on slide number 9, some of the fundamentals were the competitive position of the company. Right? Is it Coke or Pepsi or is it Monster? Is it AT&T or Verizon, or is it T-Mobile? Its compensation, growth in sales and earnings, profit margins, the dynamics of company earnings, the composition and liquidity of corporate resources, what assets are available, the company's capital structure, which is a fancy way of saying how much debt, how much equity, the capitalization of a company. Now, to me, this makes perfect sense, right? And this, and the people I like to follow and read and learn about the way they do things, that's what they do, right? That's what they tell me, you know, through their writings and their interviews. This is what they do, like Warren Buffett and Peter Lynch and Sir John Templeton and Mr. Benjamin Graham. But there are many investors, maybe we should call them speculators or traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, who don't follow the fundamentals. They're not interested in them. And those are called technical analysts. Slide number 10. Technical analysis is the study of the various forces at work in the marketplace and their effect on stock prices. Those who adhere to technical analysis believe that they can predict the future price of a stock by analyzing the behavior of the stock price's history, and or the market as a whole, the overall market as a whole, looking at a single stock or the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones or the NASDAQ. And they use any one of many dozens of so-called technical indicators. Simply put, the future price of a stock is influenced by factors other than the company's fundamental future outlook. Now, of course, I'm being either or, right? I'm saying you either do fundamental analysis or you do technical analysis. And that's just not true. There are some people like me who just stay away from technical analysis. And there are a few, I haven't met too many because I don't really run around those circles, people who don't care about fundamental analysis at all. They just use technical analysis. But obviously, many people will be somewhere in the middle. And if you look at Valueline, even they have a technical indicator. They don't really explain how they come about that, but they say, technical, what do we think the technicals are? So there, you could decide that, you know, maybe I want to be 80% fundamental, 20% technical. There's a spectrum. Slide number 11. So what's the argument in favor of technical analysis? Well, stock prices do tend to move in tandem to the stock market as a whole. You'll hear people say, the trend is your friend. When the market is rising, most stocks rise with it. A rising tide lifts all boats. When market is falling, most stocks are brought down with it. And that's when you can see, when the tide goes out, how many people were swimming naked. But there's a rebuttal to this. This is just supply and demand at work, right? When stocks are in favor, prices rise. When stocks are out of favor, prices fall. But repeat after me. There has never been a reliable methodology. Been a reliable methodology for predicting the short-term behavior of the stock market. For predicting the short-term behavior of the stock market. There are plenty of unreliable tech methods. And as Mr. Seth Klayman said, any attempt to precisely predict will give you results that are precisely wrong. Slide number 12. So let's look at some of the tools of technical analysis. The momentum buying, momentum selling, the trend is your friend, the support levels, the resistant levels. These are levels supposedly that the price cannot go above. The support level is the bottom, what it won't fall below. And the resistance level is the price that supposedly you can't get above. And who decides that? Well, you know, people who say they know what they're doing, of course. And then finally it happens, it breaks out. You know, maybe it's in this little narrow band where it pops up and down between 10 and 12 and 10 and 12 and 10. And all of a sudden it goes to 16 or goes down to 2, whatever. That's called the breakout. And then psychological barriers. You know, Dow 30,000, S&P 3,000, whatever, $100 for a stock, it can't go above $100. They're just numbers and they don't mean anything. Remember, it's just a list. And then the moving average. That's the one we're going to ask you to do as a bonus. And it's very easy, actually. And you might decide you think it's something to think about. And this is what I was doing, believe it or not. This is how I got my start in the investment world. I got a job as a programmer. I was a nerd many years ago. I'm still a nerd, but not a real nerd anymore. I have a math degree, and I was a programmer. I did scientific programming and statistical. And I happened upon a brokerage firm that wanted to do these models, these moving averages. This was when technical analysis was, you know, still pretty new. And I always thought it was just hoo-ha. You know, I did what I was told to do. I was making money, and I worked for this guy, and we built these his own system with moving averages. And what do? You just take, you go back 15 days or 50 days or 200 days and just average the prices over the last 200 days. And then the next day you do it again. It's a moving average. It's very simple. And there are dozens more, as we're going to see. So here it is. Here's the 15 or the 50 day and the 200 day. So this is six Starbucks. And you see the 50 day going above the 200 day. The 200 day is the long smoothed out green one. The blue, by the way, is the actual price. And then the red is the 50 day. So the red is not as smooth as the 200 day. So when the 50 day goes above the 200 day, that's the golden cross. That's supposed to be a bullish sign. And if it falls down below the 50 day falls below the 200 day, that's the death cross. Sometimes they call them the inflection points. Yeah. You decide. Play with it. There's an example there on the website and in Canvas for you to play with. I did it. You do it. And you'll find it's not very hard. The Dow theory. Now, I've had this thing explained to me twice, and I still don't know what the hell they're talking about. This is one of the historically popular price movement technical theories. This has been around for decades. This was, you know, it uses both the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is, as we've seen, is not really industrial, and the Dow Jones Transport Average, which is indeed transports. Of course, transports are supposed to be a future indicator of what's going on in the economy. And so they try to identify three forces: the primary direction or the trend, the secondary reaction or the trend of that, and then the daily fluctuations. By watching the changes in the primary and secondary directions of the index, you're supposed to be able to determine the overall direction of the market. And so here's an example. The primary direction seems to be bearish. The market's going down. But these are secondary, temporary departures from that primary direction. And reversions to the primary direction are something that you would expect if it were indeed the Dow Jones industrial average technical indicator that actually worked. But if you can figure it out and explain it to me, I'd be very much appreciative. Mm-hmm. Relative strength. Now, this is something that Valueline uses and Investors Business Daily uses also. This is, I don't know if I'd actually put this in the technical analysis, but it is. It's one of the technical indicators they talk about. But to me, it doesn't seem like a technical indicator. All it's doing is it's measuring the performance of one investment relative to another company, if it's a stock, or to the market as a whole. So you would be relating the relative strength of the stock you're interested in versus the market as a whole. So if the market went up 10%, your stock went up 20%, that would be a very strong indicator. Whereas if the reverse happened, it would be a weak indicator. And then people look at the volume of the market. Well, the volume is just immense. And of course, it changes every day, but we can expect billions of shares to be traded every day. Supposedly, if you have a heavy volume with prices rising, that's supposed to be a good sign. And then a low volume with prices falling is supposed to be good. So in other words, hey, the prices are rising and it's heavy volume. That's a bullish sign. If prices are falling, but it's a low volume, so don't worry about it. It's not so bad. Whereas if you have heavy volume with prices falling, well, that's bad. And if you have low volume with prices rising, that's bad also. Whereas the research behind this, I don't know. If you can find it and show it to me that it's actually reliable, I'd be very happy to be appraised of the situation. And then the breadth of the market, the advance-decline ratio. How many stocks went up? How many went down? When the mood of investors is bullish, there should be more stocks advancing as opposed to those declining. And then the opposite of true, if the investors are bearish, the advance-decline ratio should fall. Declining issues will outnumber advancing issues. But again, this to me just seems like supply and demand at work. If people are more optimistic and buying more shares, you're going to have a stronger advance-decline ratio. Great, but does that mean it's going to continue into the future? I don't know. And then the tick. The tick, what's that? That's the trade-by-trade direction of the market. Is it an uptick, a downtick? What's the opening tick? What's the closing tick? A bearish tick means the prices are going up at the end of the day or starting at the end of the day up. I'm sorry, did I say bearish? Yeah, bullish. A bullish tick means that prices are going up at the end of the day or the beginning of the day. A bearish would mean they're going down. And it used to be that the tick was important for shorting. And we'll discuss shorting later on in detail. But remember, when you short, you're trying to get the price to go down. So if the price were going down, if the tick was bearish, if the prices are moving down, you were not allowed to short. You couldn't pile in. But nowadays, with so much volume, they got rid of that rule. So you could short even if the prices are falling, which can make the price fall even farther because you're trying your best to get it to go down. But again, if it's a bona fide company with many investors all around the world, there's plenty of shares, it's a efficient market, as we said back in Chapter 7, then it's not a problem. Slide number 18. Now, here's something that actually I believe is useful, and it's something that I tend to look at. It's not that important to me, but it is something that I think is useful, and that's the short interest. The number of stocks sold short in the market at any given time. The more stocks are sold short, the more investors believe the market will fall. And for some reason, short investors are somehow considered more sophisticated and therefore supposed to know what the market will fall. This is, we saw this with the GameStop and Reddit and that what they call them, the meme stocks or the meme stocks. I don't even know how to say it. There were sophisticated investors, hedge funds, that had shorted GameStop, because they believed that this company was falling apart, which it has been for the last several years. And they can't buy a break. The poor company can't buy a break. They were trying to reinvent themselves by having game parties, having like a pizza party. But the teenagers usually, but sometimes a grown usually men, but some women, would come in and have a party and all play games together. And sometimes the parents would be there socializing. And they started that in 2019, just in time for the COVID virus to smack them once again. So what happened? And more sophisticated hedge fund people started shorting the stock. Well, the Reddit folks said, no way, we're going to beat those shorts to the punch. We're going to start buying the stock. Well, if the price goes up, the short sellers start losing a lot of money. Yeah. And so when the large number of investors sell short, eventually they must buy the shares back. Unless the company goes bankrupt, which that's what these people thought. They thought GameStop was going bankrupt. There's no way they're going to come back. And they might be right in the long term, but right now, you know, we'll see what happens. This creates a pent-up demand for stocks. So you can think of it like a compressed spring. The more shares are sold short, there's going to be what's called a short squeeze. It's going to be pop back up again when the price starts rising, because those shorts, those people who had shorted the stock are going to have to cover their shorts. That's what it's called. Reminds you of like short pants or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. They have to cover. They have to buy back those shares. And so when I see a company that I'm interested in and I see a lot of short interest, and you just look it up. It's one of the key statistics that you can look up with Yahoo or wherever. Then I kind of feel like, this might be a situation where I'm going against the grain and I'm being a bit of a contrarian, and eventually they're going to have to buy it back. But you know, often there's a reason why the stock is shorted quite a bit, because investors believe that the company is going to go down the porcelain oasis. So in this was August of 2002, you know, this was my first brutal bear market. 2-3 years the market had gone down, and I saw that. Well, actually, one of the brokers at the company I first worked at showed me, hey, look, the short interest on the New York Stock Exchange has never been higher. And I took solace in that, thinking, okay, we're probably near the end of this bear market. And we were. October 2002 was the official end, but then it fell again in March. There was a bit of a fall in March. But still, we were near the end. So when you see a whole bunch of people shorting everything, you know, eventually they're going to have to buy it back and you're going to have a short squeeze. Bing, it's going to jump up. See, this sometimes people will say, look at what the markets did the last 2 days. It's dropped precipitously. I say, relax, wait a couple of days. It'll bounce back up again. And they go, are you sure? I say, yeah. And sure enough, bingo, you know, the short sellers have to cover their shorts, and bing, it jumps back up again like a spring. Odd lot trading. Now this, I think, is, we should just take this slide away because I think it's sort of obsolete because of technology, but many technical analysts would look at how much odd lot trading was being done. This theory was based on the idea that small investors tend to buy and sell in odd lots. Remember that an odd lot is less than 100 shares. So you want to do the opposite of what the small investors, meaning people who don't have a lot of money to invest, are doing. Us, retail investors, sometimes they're called. If odd lot trading rises, it supposedly means that more and more small investors are entering the market, and supposedly that's notorious for getting, small investors are supposedly notorious for getting into the market at the top. And you know, there's no research and data to really show this. Plus, because of technology, odd lot trading is not that important anymore. You don't have to worry about it. Just do it. You might spend an extra couple of pennies, but that's about it. So you want to buy 17 shares or 10 shares, well, go ahead and buy it. And I don't take I don't give any credence to this tool. And we really should take this slide out. Yeah, consider it gone. Slide number 20, contrarian opinion. The theory is that people are very optimistic, that is a predictor of falling prices. And if people are very pessimistic, that is a predictor of rising prices. Well, you know what? This is the case. Going back in history, when people were the most optimistic, that's right before the market fell. And when they were the most pessimistic, that's when they were wrong. because the market was about ready to come back. And so we should all walk around like, oh man, the market's going to fall, market's going to go bad, and that will make the market rise, huh? Well, we've already covered the contrarian strategy, buy when others are selling, sell when others are buying, and it makes a whole lot of sense, but as we've seen, the market historically has gone up about 3 times more than it goes down. So being a contrarian is not easy. But remember what Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham and Sir John Templeton said. Buy when others are actively selling and sell when others are actively buying. But if you really want to do this, you sort of have to wait and wait and wait until the blood hits the streets. Yeah, or people are partying so much that, like now, when they're buying NTFs or NFTs or NFAs or whatever the hell they are. Non-fungible something or other. Fungible means it's kind of squishy. Slide 21, charting. Finally, we finally get to the most common form of technical analysis, and that's charting. That's the activity of charting price behavior and other market information, and then using the patterns these charts form to make investment decisions. There are high, low, closed charts, candlestick charts, bar charts adapted to stocks and other investments. Then there are the formations that we look for, resistance and support levels, and then break out of the resistance or break out of the resistance level, break down of the support level. The dreaded head and shoulders, which doesn't look like a head and shoulders in my humble opinion. Triangles, flags and pennants, cups and saucers. You know, I hear that reading tea leaves while howling at the full moon works great also, you know, but it's about as good as reading swiggles on a computer screen, in my humble opinion. But again, you're going to see hundreds of websites dedicated to teaching you how to do technical analysis, and they'll sign you up for $50 a month or $5 a month or $5,000 a month for the first 3 sessions, and then you're on your way to riches. Slide 22. Here's the open, high, low, close bar charts. Oops, I got to fix this. Look at what it did. Look at that. It cut off my clothes. So the day high was here. The day's low is here. It opened here and it closed here. So when it's red, it means it closed below what it opened. And if it's black, it means it closed above what it opened. So that's what these charts are supposed to tell you. Okay. And you're supposed to be able to divine the future from them. So as we said, yes, if it's a higher close, it's black. If it's a lower close, it's red. The longer the body, the more bearish or bullish the implication may be. And they give these formations names like a dark cloud cover, which doesn't sound very good, does it? Or a bearish engulfing pattern, which really doesn't sound good. And then there's Harami, which I'm not sure. I think it means something bad, but I don't know. But look it up. Maybe you want to use it. And divine the price for the next day or next week or next month and make riches beyond your wildest imagination. Slide 25. Here it is, folks. Here's the dreaded head and shoulders chart. You see, here's the head, and then there's the left shoulder and the right shoulder. And if you see that, oh boy, it's dangerous. Oh boy, it's dangerous. I don't know. But that's the one thing. That's the one thing about technical analysis. The one aspect of technical analysis that they asked me personally when I took the Series 7 half a million years ago. And they just asked me if I had ever heard of this basically head and shoulders thing, which is supposed to be really, really bad. Okay, it's bad. And then all the others. Here's the resistance level, and then the support level, and the resistance level, and the support level, and the resistance, and the support. And then it breaks out to the upside, or it breaks down to the bottom side. So here's the support, this is support, support, and then no more support. Maybe their drug got denied, or maybe a new competitor came out, or maybe they just screwed up. And then the triangles are supposedly something you want to follow, and the flags and the pennants are something that are very important. I don't know why, but all I can say is good luck. Slide 27. And this, remember I told you to read a random walk down Wall Street? This guy is so much fun. Professor Burton Malkiel. And he skewers the fundamental analysis. He skewers the technical analysis. And he skewers his own system that he was one of the academics that created efficient market theorists. He's an equal opportunity insulter, which is the guy right after my own heart. So this is something that was really said by some technical analysts. The market's rise after a period of reaccumulation is a bullish sign. Nevertheless, fulcrum characteristics are not yet clearly defined present, and a resistance area exists 40 points higher in the Dow. So it is clearly premature to say the next leg of the bull market is up. If in the coming weeks a test of the lows holds and the market breaks out of its flag, a further rise would be indicated. Should the lows be violated, a continuation of the intermediate term downward trend is called for. In view of the current situation, it is a distinct possibility that traders will sit in the wings awaiting a clearer delineation of the trend and the market will move in a narrow trading range. Now, what do you think he said or she said? This is something, this is 1970s, I think. What do you think they said? They said, I think it means, I'm not sure, but I think it means that the market does not go up or the market goes doesn't go down, it will remain unchanged. That's what I get out of it. It's either going to go up or down, or it's going to stay the same. And he gets paid a lot of money to say this, folks. This is from A Random Walk Down Wall Street. So please read the book. You can download it to your phone for free, I think, from your library. It's very cool. Libraries are cool, folks. Slide 28. Now, I've been bugging you all semester long that there's a future for you in the industry. So let's talk about the future. Typically, people who want to go into stocks become a stockbroker or broker's an aid to start, but there are many other positions in the industry. The legal term is a registered representative. You are a financial representative. You have been, they've done a background check. They take your fingerprints and I guess they call the FBI to make sure you haven't had any shenanigans with other people's money. You must take the Series 7 and the Series 63. Now, some people say they're taking the 66, but they're very similar. The Series 7 is the bugaboo. It's difficult, folks. I won't try to sugarcoat it, but it's not impossible. It's 6 hours, though. It's a day. 3 hours in the morning, you get an hour for lunch, and then 3 hours in the afternoon. 120 questions each 3 hours, or is it 180? No, it's 120. 2 months of studying, 1 to 2 hours a day. That's what it takes. The Series 63, 66, they're much easier. It's 1 hour, and it takes about 2 to 4 weeks of studying, 1 to 2 hours a day. And this is the kicker. This is the thing that makes it difficult. You must be sponsored by a brokerage firm. And brokerage firms are a little reticent to sponsor somebody until they know they can pass the Series 7. So what has done is that it's made it difficult. Throughout the later 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, people, they just weren't hiring. So now we have this huge older group of people like me who are about ready to retire or die, and they need younger folks. They know they need younger folks. That's why they've created this FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which is the nonprofit organization that oversees the brokers on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. They have created this new exam called the Securities Industry Exam. Securities Industry Essentials Exam. You don't have to be sponsored, and it's relatively cheap. The Series 7 costs several hundred dollars for the background check and all the other stuff they have to do, whereas Securities Industry Exam, I think it's $65 or $85. That's not that expensive. So check it out, and you'll look at the curriculum, and you'll see it's pretty much what we teach in this class. Now, there's some other stuff that we don't talk about, the compliance stuff that we don't really get into, but you have to learn it. So, you'll forget it as soon as you take the exam. You'll forget it, but you'll remember that if anybody ever complains about you, how many days do I have to tell my boss? Well, I would tell them right away, but some brokers would just say, maybe they'll cool down and not be so angry tomorrow. So there's a certain number of days, and I don't remember what they are that you have until you have to. If somebody has a complaint about you. But seriously, folks, I heartily recommend that you consider a career in the industry. And you don't have to be a stockbroker. There's so many positions. It's a huge industry. Plus, there's insurance agents. Everybody needs insurance. Not everybody needs investments, although they should, in my humble opinion. There's a mortgage broking. Oh my goodness. The mortgage brokers make the most money, but they work so many hours. It's so stressful. And then of course, banking, right? Banking, you start as a, they don't, like U.S. Bank, they don't call them bank tellers anymore. Now they call them personal bankers, bankers. I like that. In other words, like customer service representatives. And then of course, real estate world is immense, and there's escrow and title insurance and appraisals and all the things that the real estate industry has that are financial. So there's a future for you. Did I mention that the salaries are higher than the national averages? And what I love about being a stockbroker is that you can slide. You can really slide. You can work as hard as you want, or you can work as little as you want. Once you have your clientele, that's the hard part. But one of the wholesalers from American Funds said it best. She goes, "I like working during the market hours." In other words, you're in here on the West Coast, you're done by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 2 or 3 o'clock. The market's it's closed at 4 o'clock New York time, closes at 1 o'clock our time. But we get up early. We get up early. The market opens at 6:30. So by you come to our office at 2:30, it's gone. Everybody's gone by then. So I like that. Whereas the mortgage brokers, oh my goodness, they're working 12 hours a day. So have I convinced you that there's a future for you in the industry? Contact me, contact a counselor. We want you to be awesome. And that, dear students, is our long discussion, a long journey about stocks, because stocks are where it's at. Stocks are exciting. Stocks are sexy. Stocks are risky. And now we're ready to learn about bonds. Boring bonds, stodgy bonds, reliable bonds. Thank you so much, dear students. We can't say enough how proud and honored and grateful and happy we are that you're still with us so far. Be awesome!